you can remember a couple of weeks ago, chapter 6 in this study ended by asking two questions. Look at verse 12. Question 1. Who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life which he passes like a shadow? Question 2. Who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? Now, the preacher, Koheleth is called, Hebrew name for him, answered the first question, who knows what is good for man, in the first 12 verses of chapter 7. And the short version of what he gave us, therefore, the answer is, what is good is for us to face our vulnerability, being forced into somber contemplation about the end of life and being rebuked. And in the long run, that's really good for us. Even though we don't like it in the short run, that is what's good for us, is to sit down and seriously contemplate life and its end. And we know from experience that the pain that we endure throughout life really does turn out for our good. We don't like it, but it's for our good. Now, the second question. Who knows what comes next? And the simple answer to that is, well, nobody, except it's answered here in our text. God, who puts crookedness in our paths of life, He knows. More than that, he knows why he brings adverse circumstances into our lives. God knows what he plans to accomplish in our lives by dragging us through trial. And I state it that way on purpose. That is the opening argument in James' letter. You've read this many times. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. Let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. Those ideas are all connected in that passage on purpose. Your trials, God's purpose for your trials, and what you need in those trials. And that's the same thing we find in our text. The key in facing our trials effectively for the glory of God is wisdom. Now, the preacher in our text, I'm pretty sure is Solomon. I've said that before. He already explained to us the source of wisdom, the very first source of wisdom that we need to know in order to navigate these crooks in our life. He's the one who penned Proverbs chapter 10, chapter 9, verse 10. The fear of the Lord. That's the beginning of wisdom. And the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. And I don't have to stand here this evening and tell you folks that life is full of ups and downs, twists and turns, always unexpected circumstances. How do we keep our equilibrium while we're trying to navigate, walk on such a treacherous path? Well, we must know God well, so well, that we rest solidly in the truth of His sufficient Word. That's what sustains us in the trials. And so the wise man Solomon, the preacher, tells us to consider God's work. And what he means by that is, you watch God and you learn. Consider is the work of God, verse 13. Who can make straight what He has made crooked? Now, actually, the first word in this text is a significant word because it shows up several times in the text. You see it there at the beginning of verse 1. Consider, verse 13, first verse of our text, consider the work of God. We'll look down at verse 14. In the day of adversity, what are you supposed to do? Same thing. Consider. Now look down at verse 15. In my vain life, I have seen everything. Well, that's the same Hebrew word. It just happens to be translated differently in the English. So three times in three verses, you find this very significant Hebrew word. And like most Hebrew words, it has a very broad range of meanings. Because the word will mean something like to regard or to perceive or to feel maybe or understand or learn and even enjoy. And really, we can put all of those ideas together, and this is what God would have us to do. As we are thinking about God's works in our life, stop. Think about it. Contemplate. We're not supposed to face the frustrations of life, the trials of life, with fear, discouragement, frustration. Nor are we supposed to adopt an attitude of fatalism. Like, oh, well, that's just the way life is, and it's always that way for me. I'm just a Ziggy, and that's the way life's going to turn out. I'm always the victim of circumstances. You could do that. And God says, no, that's not what I want you to do. There is a very good reason for why we are in the trial we are in, whenever that might be. There's a good reason for it. We'll figure it out. Think. Learn. Perceive. Come to understand why these things are happening in your life. And we're going to talk in a moment about exercising human wisdom to come to these conclusions and realize that's not what God's telling us to do. Look at the object of consideration. You're not focusing on the circumstances. You're not really focusing on the why. You're focusing on the who. Consider the work of God. What is God doing? That's the question that we're supposed to answer. Who had greater, more inexplicable trials than Job? You have to remember that Job had absolutely no earthly idea, no inkling, that God had actually given Satan permission to crush Job. Job was completely ignorant of that thought. And in light of all of his efforts to be righteous and right before God, and chapter 1 lists those for us, it had to be incredibly difficult for him to try to figure out what in the world was going on. And this is why his whole argument is about, what is God doing in my life? I mean, he did not dismiss God. He did not say, well, these are just the circumstances of life. Job was arguing, this is about God. Why the pain? Why the suffering? I've tried to be righteous. And while he's suffering, his dear friend, the miserable counselor, Elihu, challenges him with some good advice. Hear this, O Job. Stop and consider. There's that word. Think about it. Contemplate. Try to perceive the wondrous works of God. The same exact thing we're told in Ecclesiastes. In fact, in a very similar way, God even said the same thing to Job. Job 38, verse 3. Dress for action like a man. I will question you and you make known. You reveal to me through your consideration. You tell the facts. Tell the truth, Job, if you can figure me out. God was simply forcing Job to do what our text asks us to do. Think. Perceive, understand. And then God graciously revealed himself to Job. And that forced Job to clearly see God's hand behind all his trouble. That's what God wants us to see. His conclusion, Job 42, verse 5. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Want to guess what that word sees is? Same word that's in our text. Now my eye considers you. It contemplates you. It understands you. Job could finally see clearly that he never saw clearly. That's what trials do for us. It helps us see clearly that we were in a fog all the time. That we really didn't understand God and that we really didn't know God. And this is the purpose of trials. But we have difficulty. Right? I mean, that sounds good. It's theoretical. Let's put it in real life. How do you understand why you or a loved one has to suffer chronic illness? Explain that. How could what appeared at the beginning to be the perfect marriage end up in divorce? How does that happen? You know, why would a child who's reared in a very solid, sound Christian home choose to go out and live in gross sin and try to justify it? Now, how does that happen? Where was God when I lost my job after sacrificing my life for the company all those years? And then they just let me go. You know, where's God in all that stuff? Or are these just accidents? Are they unexpected, unplanned circumstances? Or are they what Solomon said here? The works of God. Now, let me put that very frankly. Is your trial just a circumstance of life? Or is God doing this trial to you? That's a hard thing to think about. And this idea that it's God who makes things crooked, it just flies in the face of everything we feel and think. Last part of verse 13. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? Now, this is the second time that the preacher has brought up this idea of life being characterized by crooked things. If you look back at chapter 1, verse 15, for example. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. So, the preacher realizes in that case, there just are times in life when you look at life and it is crooked. There are these crooks and turns, and what can you do about it? I mean, the reality is, the road of life is never straight. It's never simple. It's never clear. We really do wish in our hearts that our life's path was nice and straight and boring like Interstate 70 cutting through Kansas. What a boring road. Those of you who are from Kansas know what I'm talking about. There's one turn, I think, in the whole road. Life's not like that, folks. Life is like old Route 19 cutting through West Virginia, right, brother? That's crooked as a dog's hind leg the whole way. And that's what your life looks like. Oh, we wish it was straight. But there's a big difference between Solomon's acknowledgement in chapter 1, verse 15, that there are crooks in life. And when I use that word, by the way, I'm not talking about thieves and robbers. I'm talking about crooks, okay, crooked things. In 1:15, Solomon just acknowledges, you know, that's the way life is. There are crooks. It's a fact. Our text says, yes, there are crooks and turns in your life. and God put them there. That's the part that's hard for us to handle, because it means God has sovereign control over all these difficult things in your life. And thinking about, perceiving, trying to understand God's works leads us to the conclusion that it is God who makes the road crooked. And whose road was more crooked than Job's? And who made that road crooked? Job 40. Verse 1 through verse 5, the Lord said to Job, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once. I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further." Job figured it out. God is almighty, in complete control. And when he wants to put a crook in the road, he puts a crook in the road. Joseph figured that out. Why, we ask, was Joseph's life so painful? Why the awful crooks and turns in Joseph's road? Why did he have to suffer at the hands of his brothers? Why was he beaten by his brothers? Why was he put in a pit? Why was he sold to Midianite slave traders? Why was he sold to Potiphar? Why was he falsely accused by Potiphar's wife? Why did he languish in prison? Why? Joseph says, "I got it all figured out." But not in the middle of it. He waited on God and came to this conclusion for his brothers. "And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." Oh, it made sense. Perfect sense. God did this. It wasn't an accident. It really wasn't his brothers being more powerful than Joseph. It was God letting them do that. And no one can change what God does. You know, the essential work, I think, of sinful, rebellion, humanity is to attempt to change God's work. And typically that simply amounts to maybe renaming God's work or reinterpreting God's work. You know, something like, whatever God has called evil, they call good. Whatever God calls good, sinful, rebellious humanity calls evil. But there's also a danger for God's children trying to do something like that. We grow weary of the road that God sets before us. And we conclude it just has too many crooks and turns and too many hills and too many valleys. So we respond by simply trying to straighten out the crooked paths. And that doesn't mean that God wants you to sit back and be a fatalist. No, we trust Him. We try to work for the best. But we are going to wear ourselves out trying to conform God to our will. Isn't that what we do? Far better response is for us to just simply acknowledge, you know, God has all power, all majesty, all wisdom, all love for us. Rest. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. Why are you fretting? You know what that looks like? Here's the difference. If you grew up in the country or on the farm, you get this. If you don't, trust me. Go out to the hen house, look in the hen house while the hen is on the nest, maybe laying an egg. Just as quiet and serene, peaceful. God says, "Rest in me, you look like that." But now the farmer's hungry. So he goes and gets that hen, and trust me, folks, this is what you do. You hold that hen by the feet and put that hen on the old stump and you take an axe and cut its head off. And then you let go of the hen. You know what it does? Runs around the barnyard.
like a chicken with his head off. That's where the phrase came from. And that's what we look like when we're trying to make God's will conform to our will. We're just running helter-skelter with no sense at all. We don't even have our head about us. And God says, would you just slow down? Or would you consider? Or would you just stop and think about who I am and what I'm doing? That looks an awful lot like stability. So, when we're trusting God, guess what we do? We rejoice in the good times. Verse 14, in the day of prosperity, be joyful. It's very easy for us to try to obey that challenge by finding joy in favorable circumstances. Don't do that. They're going to change. Or we try to rejoice in stuff. Well, don't do that. It passes away. You have to get a new one. Don't even rejoice in relationships. They change overnight. All you have to do is say something wrong or do something wrong and it's over. Don't rejoice in your good feelings. Your heart is deceitful. Rejoice in the day of prosperity because of your knowledge and of your relationship with God. He's the source of your true joy. That's why we rejoice. On the other hand, it's good for us to stop once in a while and contemplate the bad times. Or, as Solomon said in verse 14, in the day of adversity, consider. Stop and think. Try to perceive. Try to understand. There are just going to be times of adversity in your life. We're going to talk later about Thomas Boston's book, The Crook in the Lot. I mean, this was the text, verse 13, that he chose for writing that book. You have those. You're going to have times of adversity. You're going to have dark times. You're going to have difficult times. When you're in the midst of those times, do the same thing. Stop, consider, think, perceive, try to understand, and come to this conclusion. This is why we're considering, so we can trust God. Last part of verse 14, God has made the one. That is the day of prosperity or the day of adversity. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. You know, it's a repetition of the principle he just gave us in verse 13. Who put the crook in your road? God. Who makes the good times? Who makes the bad times? Well, God. Now, we naturally believe that God makes the good times. Well, who makes the bad times? Everybody knows that. It's the devil, or your neighbor, or your coworker, or your spouse, you know, somebody, maybe somebody who Satan's working through. Now, we cannot forget this reality. All trouble, all sickness, all pain, all loss, all struggle, I mean, it is all the result of the sin principle. We know that. I mean, everything began to wind down in God's perfect creation. Everything began to wind down when Adam brought sin into Eden. We know that. And we all face the effects of sin all the time. And all of the troubles and all the problems and all the crooks in your road are the effect of sin. There's no question about that. Who authored the consequences of sin? Wasn't the devil. It's God. God said, here are the consequences. That's what we're dealing with. Satan is the original sinner. We know that. He's the father of lies. He's a murderer from the beginning. He is a supernatural troublemaker. But he has to operate within the boundaries that God allows. I don't think we can even imagine what it would be like if Satan had complete authority to operate according to his will outside of any boundaries that God establishes. And that truth could not possibly be demonstrated any better than by the permission that God gave
for Satan to crush Job. In fact, remember, God brought it up. See, God introduced that to Satan. The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" We do well to stop and think about that. Consider that it is God's work to put crooks in our roadway. And once you've come to that conclusion, then rest. Rest in God's will and His work. Verse 14, last part. So that man may not find out anything that will be after him. With all your work and all your contemplation and all of your thinking and all of your perceiving and all of your understanding, you will never thoroughly find out God's plan. He says, I want you to stop and consider so that you come to the conclusion, I'm doing this. Now, sit back and rest. Trust God fully to lead you in that path. That's faith. And here's a very important lesson in this whole text. Faith is the critical aspect of wisdom. Now, I'm going to take you just shortly on a little path here, and you're going to get confused if just stick with me, okay? It's not going to get too deep. Faith is the critical aspect of wisdom. What did James say? In the midst of trials, anyone who lacks wisdom, ask from God. Let me show you something about this passage. It is bookended by the statements about wisdom. Chapter 7, verse 10. Don't say, why were the former, the good old days good? Don't say that. That does not come from wisdom. Verse 11. Wisdom is good with an inheritance. Verse 12. The protection of wisdom is like the protection of money. And then we have our text. Trials come from God. You need wisdom. Verse 19, right after our text. Wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers to a city. Wisdom. Faith is a critical aspect of that wisdom. All faith in God's control of all matters of life will lead us to conclude with Job in the midst of the dark valleys and difficult times when we're confused. Faith coming from wisdom will make us say with Job chapter 1 verse 21, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked shall I return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That's faith. Comes from wisdom. Job 13 verse 15. Though he slay me, I will hope in him. That's faith. It comes from wisdom. So the preacher says, now consider life's experiences. You have considered the truth about God. What is he doing? Well, he's working in life. All right, then observe life and learn from that. He said in verse 15, in my vain life, I have seen everything. Again, that means he has considered, just like he told us to do. He says, I've already done this. I'm telling you to do this. I've been observant. I have been learning. I've been trying to understand. And we would say, well, wait a minute. Nobody sees everything. Only God sees everything. That's true. But what the preacher's telling us here is this. I've been watching in life. I've been considering. I've been thinking. I've been trying to understand. And I'm trying to see. I've been seeing all kinds of things. And that is possible. And that's what he did. He said, what I learned from that is this. In life, there are plenty of crooks. How do you explain bad things happening to good people? Of course that happens. How do you explain good things happening to bad people?
And Solomon says, you know, there's plenty of evidence. If you just pay attention to life, if you just look around you, you will see there's plenty of evidence that God is doing His work for His glory in the lives of real people. And most people prefer to try to ignore the work of God, and they bring in the bright lights, and they bring in the loud sounds and music and all the distractions possible to try to not think about what God is doing. In fact, many people just become unrealistic. They try the power of positive thinking, and they try to put a positive spin on everything, and they would never come to the conclusion God brings crooks to our lives. But Solomon says the facts are clear. We see these things, everything. And what we realize is good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people. And sometimes life just doesn't seem fair. I know you've never said that. I've said that. Way more than I should. We have a grandson who just turned 3 last Sunday. And several times this past week we heard him say, "Hey, that's not fair." And our son was telling us that some adult at their church, their family church, commented on that and said, "Wow, it's amazing that a little guy this little, this young, is able to grasp, you know, such a deep concept." Our son Mark said, "Well, wait, he doesn't grasp at all. He has no idea what he's talking about. He just heard the older kids say that, so he says that. He really doesn't know what he's talking about, and neither do I. When I say life's not fair, and neither do you. It doesn't seem fair when the righteous man perishes. How can that be fair?" Verse 15. "There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness." I mean, that's exactly what was happening to Job. How do you explain a young family who loses their father and husband in an accident? Man, that's not fair. How does a person who has the limited human knowledge, and only that, explain the torture and crucifixion of the most righteous man who ever lived? How do you explain that? Our finite human wisdom says that nothing like that should happen to good people. Ever. Worse might be the reality that good things happen to bad people. And that shouldn't be true either. But the preacher says the wicked man prospers. The one who prolongs his life in his evil doing. That's not right, is it? Mark Twain's The Story of the Bad Little Boy Who Didn't Come to Grief. Short story. You read about an irresponsible boy named Jim. Typical fashion of an irresponsible, rebellious little creature, he decides to break into Farmer Acorn's farmyard, climbs his apple tree, steals his apples, and the branch doesn't break. And the farmer's dog doesn't come out and bite him. And he doesn't fall out of the tree. In fact, he gets away with it. Later we learned that he decided to go fishing on Sunday. And he didn't fall out of the boat and drown. Another time he went fishing on Sunday and storm came up and he didn't get struck by lightning. In fact, the whole story about Jim is he's just an evil man. And all through his life he gets away with his mischief. Twain concludes the story writing how Jim, quote, "got wealthy by all manner of cheating and rascality, and now he is the infernalest, wickedest scoundrel in his native village and is universally respected and belongs to the legislature." And we know that too well, and we say, that's not right. Why do bad men prosper? And why does God allow men like Hugh Hefner, Jeffrey Epstein, to live the good life
until they die.
I mean, it's totally not fair in my thinking for God to allow that a mass murderer ends the whole episode by committing suicide instead of coming to justice so that the victim's families can have a little closure. That never seems right to me. And so I repeat the mantra that means almost nothing. Life is not fair. Life's not fair. You know what fair is? Fair is justifiable. You know what justifiable is? Justice is God sending every one of us to hell for eternity the moment we're born, because we're born in sin and offense against Him. That's fair. Oh, I don't want life to be fair. I think I'll turn more and depend on God's grace and mercy. Because it's in not in God's justice and His fairness, but in His grace and mercy that He offers the blood of Jesus Christ, His own beloved Son, to cover the payment for my sin and offenses against Him. That grace and mercy is what I want. And it's because of God's grace and mercy that He allows His choicest servants to endure hardships. So that we might become like Jesus Christ, our Savior. Folks, that's grace and mercy. We don't deserve that kind of honor. And the one who fears God learns how to benefit from this whole process. In the final verse of our text, Solomon teaches that there's really a balance to wisdom. In fact, we quickly realize that we need wisdom when we simply read this statement. What a weird statement. Be not overly righteous, verse 16. Do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Wait. Doesn't God command righteousness? Well, yeah. But notice the idea here is overly righteous. Oh. Well, what? Just tell me what the level is. Where's the bar? You know, so I can come up to this level of righteousness, but I don't want to go over that. Well, what this means is this. Don't be self-righteous. Don't try to persuade God by your self-righteousness. That's overly righteous. Learn that real, true righteousness comes from God by the grace and mercy of God. It is the righteousness of Jesus Christ. He gives us. It is a gift to us. Overly righteousness is trying to impress God with our own righteousness. And the same thing is true about wisdom. Nor should you be too wise. Well, what's too wise? Wise in your own conceits? You know, sometimes we're confused about true wisdom, I think. There's human wisdom, and we talk about that often. It is simply the amassing, the gathering of facts about passing things so the facts keep changing. It is the ability to take all of those facts that we have amassed and put them to work. It's what Paul calls the wisdom of the world, 1 Corinthians chapter 1. But we know that true wisdom does not flow from a fallen nature. It can't. That's the wisdom of this world. True wisdom, instead, is found on a right attitude about God. We opened with this verse. Proverbs 9:10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Knowledge of the Holy One is insight. The fear of the Lord, the right attitude about God, the right view of God, comes from knowing Him. And when we know Him, we are fully convinced that God is awesomely fearful. He is fearsome because with a mere thought, He can destroy us forever. Okay, that's fear. And the fear of the Lord understands that that same God loves us so immensely that He gave His own blood to help me not be an offense to Him, to cover over my sins. same God. That's the fear of the Lord. And true wisdom rests in that knowledge, that understanding of God. True wisdom, therefore, is confident in this relationship with that God. Now think about it. Here is God in all His power and all His might and all His majesty, and He can do whatever He wants to do, and He loves me, and I fear Him with an awesome respect. Well, what does that do? How does that work out in life? If the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, how does that work? True wisdom does not have to figure out the mysteries of life. True wisdom is not the amassing of enough facts to be able to explain in detail difficult situations. That's all human wisdom. Now, this will shock you, but listen to me. True wisdom is not completely, wholly, only the right application of Bible truths. Although that is a lot of true wisdom, is gaining the knowledge of the Bible and being able to make that knowledge work in life. Yes, that is wisdom, but that's not all that it is. True wisdom knows how to rest in God's sovereign control of all things. That's true wisdom. True wisdom is demonstrated by three young Hebrew men who are willing to walk into the fiery furnace. True wisdom is demonstrated by Daniel, who does not resist being thrown into a den of lions. They rested in God's sovereign control of all things. So don't try to be overly righteous, self-righteous. Don't try to be too wise, human wisdom. Rest in God. On the other side of that coin, don't be wicked either, because that lives a short life. Do not be overly wicked. Neither be a fool, for why should you die before your time? Now, God isn't saying, all right, a little wickedness, that's good, but don't be overly wicked. I mean, God can't be saying that. You know, common sense gives us the answer to this. It is sufficient to teach us that drug lords and mafia members and gang members and thieves and pimps, they just generally don't live long lives, folks, do they? And who ever heard of retirement programs for people like that? Yeah, they don't need them. They're not going to live that long. They come to a short end. And really, you read through Proverbs, and that's what it's all about, contrasting the fool with the wise person. Now, the person who fears God gets this whole principle. They have grasped this truth that God is in control. Verse 18. It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand. In all your considering, come to this conclusion, that the sovereign God is in control of all things, including the good and the bad. Faith grasps this paradox firmly. Human wisdom cannot, and only gets frustrated thinking about it. But if we will fear God the way that we should, He will keep us in balance. Verse 18, the last part of the verse, the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. What? Okay, let's review. What does it mean to fear God? We know Him. We respect Him. And therefore, we trust Him implicitly, completely, leaning on Him wholly. That attitude will keep us from becoming self-righteous. And that attitude will keep us from thinking that we have to come up with all the answers to all of life's dilemmas. Folks, sometimes we don't have answers. And that fear will keep us from yielding to the evil desires of our flesh, which will force us to try to find an easy way out, an easy explanation, even though it's a wrong one, so that we can somehow avoid walking through the crooks of our life. Fear God. In conclusion, I want to call to your attention, I've pointed at it several times over the last few weeks. The Scottish Puritan Thomas Boston, faithful pastor, labored in the same parish, same church for over 25 years. Yeah, he was a preacher, but he was given to discouragement, depression, like Spurgeon was. Maybe a quick review of his life kind of explains to us why he was discouraged and depressed. He himself was often in poor health. We learn from his memoirs that his wife suffered from a chronic illness, was not able to help much in the ministry. Somehow, he and his wife were able to give birth to 10 children. 6 of them died. Boston named one of his sons, who ultimately died, Ebenezer. It means, "Hitherto hath the Lord helped us." But he died. Philip Ryken, writing about Boston in his commentary on Ecclesiastes, said this, quote, "When his wife gave birth to another son, Boston considered naming the boy Ebenezer as well. Yet the minister hesitated. Naming the boy Ebenezer would be a testimony of hope in the faithfulness of God. But what if that child died too and the family had to bury another Ebenezer? Now, that would be a loss too bitter to bear. But by faith, Boston decided to name his new son Ebenezer. And the child was sickly. And despite the urgent prayers of his parents, he never recovered. And as the grieving father wrote in his memoirs, quote, "It pleased the Lord that he also removed him from me." That's the man who wrote this classic work, The Crook in the Lot, based on this text, Ecclesiastes 7, verse 13. The full title, the subtitle, is The Crook in the Lot, The Sovereignty and Wisdom of God and the Afflictions of Men Displayed. And he divided that book into three propositions that I want to give you here this evening that tell us how to handle these crooks in the road. Proposition number one. Whatever crook there is in our law, it is of God's making. It's not an accident. It's not just a circumstance. God did this. Proposition number two. What God sees suitable to mar, we shall not be able to mend in our lot. What crook God makes in our lot, we shall not be able to even. When God does it, who can move it? Proposition number three. Considering the crook in the law as the work of God is a proper means to bring one to behave rightly under it. Consider. Stop and think. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what He has made crooked? And if you'll think about that and gain the wisdom that comes from a right relationship with God, a fear of the Lord, you'll understand how to behave rightly under God's sovereign control. What is it? What does that look like? It is to maintain a right relationship with God, a right view of God, and a right understanding of God's works.
And that right consideration is the essence of faith. That's what it means, folks. When we are fully leaning on God alone in the good times and in the bad times. And you will always find that He is faithful. You will not always understand. You will not always be able to explain the details. But you will always find God faithful. Because He puts the crooks in our lot according to His purposes to make us like Himself. So let's trust Him.